Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
The success and health of our society starts in the pregnant belly. So why are we feeding children so badly, and mothers as well? The shocking reality of baby food. Even in the premium organic aisles, over 90% of the food you find is fruit puree, apple, pear, and banana. Of course, organic, but still sugar nonetheless. And there's no scientific backing for that at all. The first foods of babies shouldn't be fruit at all, but should be vegetables, things that are bitter, maybe a bit acidic. Of course, they might not love it immediately, but they need to be exposed to it to learn how to eat it later and to become the non-picky eaters we all need and to become healthy. This is an episode where we dive deep into baby nutrition and the first 1,000 days and why the current baby food industry really, really needs a shakeup. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems, while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt slash soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today with Jacqueline Snow, the co-founder of Pumpkin Organics, and we're going to dive deep into baby food and what's the role of nutrition there, science, a lot of folklore, I think, and why and how it's such a pivotal moment for many people in terms of food, in terms of nutrition, in terms of food choices as well. So I'm very, very happy to unpack that and a lot more today. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you. It's such a great pleasure to be here.
And to start with that personal question we always like to throw at people first, how did you end up working on and co-founding a baby food company?
Yeah, I get this question all the time. People just assume I have a baby or I had a baby and, oh, I didn't like what was in the market. But that's not it at all.
Because I think many people do that and then they don't start a baby food company. Otherwise, we would have millions and millions of baby food companies. I mean, many people maybe sort of start a baby food company in their kitchen for a while and then transition to other things in a very small scale. In this case, there's a different story behind it.
Yeah, so I've been in the food industry, the commercial food industry, almost my entire professional life. And I was
excited. But you're still in the commercial food industry.
Like it's
It's okay. Interesting when people say that the intensive, I say, yeah, but you can do intensive differently. I hope this is commercial, otherwise we would be talking to a nonprofit, which is also fine, but that was not the intention. It's very interesting how we frame that.
Yeah, okay. For me, the commercial food industry are these big guys that are driven by lobbyists and driven by Wall Street expectations that actually are not driven by purpose. Or fancy marketing claims, or that have gigantic research and consumer insight budgets that are actually doing this with their own purpose and passion and funding. And also really, I've got almost all of my friends and family invested in pumpkin. So if I don't make this work, I'm going to have a very lonely Christmas dinner coming up.
At least you have a lot of food. Yeah.
Yeah, true. At least we will have a lot of food. You know, the reality is I really entered the big food company with a vision that I was going to change nutrition, that I was going to change and have an impact on the way we grow food, the way we serve food, the way food integrates into family. And that's not how it works. I was so amazed. It works by what your manager says from plans 1 to 2 years ago. It's driven by, like in the US where I started, by lobbyists and Wall Street. We were incentivized by cutting out real aspects of nutrition because the customer didn't maybe value it. So we could put something cheaper in or do it a more economical way. But these,
do you have an example of that? Like just to most shocking one, or just the one, or the first one that triggered like, whoa, we switched this for this, and just from a nutrition or taste perspective, it doesn't make any sense.
I had a couple trigger moments in my few years of the starving that made me say, okay, I'm in this, but I'm going to make massive change or I have to switch because it's against every fundamental value. And one was a very standard boxed meal product in the US where the middle class, it's a billion-dollar brand. And it had real cheese powder in it, one of the only real components of nutrition in it. And they did consumer testing and they realized that it was the taste of the cheese. It wasn't the nutrition of the cheese. So they took the real cheese out and put a synthetic flavoring in. So basically, it was about shipping air in a box that had a
worse than
air.
Yeah,
completely.
Worse than air.
Absolutely. And okay. The person was put on a stage and celebrated at our annual, meeting that they truly understood consumer insight and they drove massive cost savings to the company, which were both true, absolutely true. But I had a feeling in my stomach and more importantly, like my brain,
literally,
and I'm saying,
yeah,
like this is not what science says. Science is so clear on how nutrition can work. And not only that, we see it with increasing lifestyle diseases, like the top health issues in almost every society in the world are man or people caused. We cause them. So you cannot tell me that this is not, that there's no connection to what the food industry offers. And that was the first trigger. Right? So that's, this is
and,
not funny.
And then why and how? I mean, I understand the why really well, but what was the trigger to start focusing on that first 1,000 days or the first baby set? Because you clearly mentioned in the beginning, it wasn't because we were in the kitchen trying to figure out what to feed our child. And no, there's a more rational, that's also very rational actually, but a different why you started with this. And of course, your plans are much bigger than the first, let's say, period we are eating food that is not like potentially breast milk or milk in general. Why did you focus on that first 1,000 days? Is that science driven again? Is that, and what insight came there?
Absolutely. So I come from the middle of Canada in Saskatchewan, which is one of the biggest farmlands in the world. My father is a chemistry professor fully dedicated to the farm industry. And so I grew up before, just learning to walk and talk, but also learning about the chemistry of food and soil and growing. So I knew there was a better way to do things. I didn't know where this knowledge would come into my life or where I would need it later on. But growing up with, the excitement of seeing your tomato plant grow because you put eggshells that you had kept all year and then made this, calcium phosphorus distillation, or we put Coke on the one beside it. So we studied the impact of sugar on just life, let alone growth. As a young child, I had this inside of me that there was something wrong with sugar.
So you were doing these experiments basically in your back
garden
with
our
your father.
Was a lab. The
wow.
lab, it was amazing.
Side by side experiments. What was a shocking one? I mean, sugar for tomatoes sounds interesting,
sugar.
But like you made ketchup. What was the...
Completely, yes. But it was really the impact of sugar. Okay. And of course, my father knew all of this, right? He's a chemistry professor focused on all of this. And for me, it was fascinating to see this innocent little white powder that is in everything. And okay, I'm 43. So take back a few years. Nobody questioned putting sugar on everything. Nobody questioned anything on proper nutrition at this time.
Which was very interestingly framed back in the day. If you go back, if you want to go into the conspiracy rabbit hole, like the whole fat versus sugar and
oh,
how
absolutely.
Sugar became the issue and not fat, with some very interesting lobbying. I'm laughing about it, but actually it's horrible. Very interesting lobbying from certain industries. And now we're starting to see sugar is driving a lot of this.
It's sugar, it's not fat.
Yeah. Which is very interesting. I mean, you saw already that even on like adding sugar to soil, fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And you saw it because even the soil changed its molecular structure. It changed its pH level. It changed its, viscosity level. Again, as a young child, you don't know what all of this means, but you saw the change. And I think that's the important part also that you see it and you can be part of it.
And you taste it. Very, very young.
Yes.
Obviously.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And that was the other thing. We put it on carrots and it made no taste. And actually the carrots didn't grow as big. So it's like the tomatoes collapsed when we put the Coke on it. But when we had our carrot row, and one row, instead of just digging the seeds, we put little sugar cubes in the bottom. They didn't grow as much. They were smaller. Now, I don't know any cause and effect on this, but as a child, these are the images that stayed with me for a lot, you know, and even now drive a lot of the choices I make on how we look at the food company.
And then how did you end up founding a baby food company in Germany? Because you're the middle from farmland in Canada. That's literally culturally distance-wise pretty far.
Yeah, the other side of the world. But I met my husband doing we did our MBAs at Harvard together, and he's German. And after business school, we moved to Europe, and then we wanted to settle either Canada or Germany, and Munich came up. And I just think the city is amazing and beautiful and really based on an outside way of living. So I said, yeah, let's go for it. And we loved the choice. And this is really one of the fundamental beginnings of Pumpkin. I was working here and just feeling extremely down, no energy for years. I went to numerous doctors, from TCM to, you know, Ayurvedic to traditional, and nobody could solve what was happening. And this is one of the most frustrating aspects, is people don't take general aches and pains in the body seriously. They just think, oh, you're too stressed, you're working too hard, blah, 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 every excuse under the sun. Anyways, after a couple of years, I was finally correctly diagnosed with Hashimoto's. And this, I left my job and I put the entire rigor and my passion for everything into solving Hashimoto's or an autoimmune condition with food. You can't stop autoimmune, but you can slow it down and you can change the trajectory of your, you know, how it's going to work in your body. And this is where I started. One of the benefits of having a network like the Harvard network is I called some of the most amazing doctors in the world. And I gave them these challenges. I want to solve this with food. And food means also, how do we grow the food? How do, you know, I get the right nutrients out of the food? Because one of the biggest issues of our society is we eat food with a quarter of the nutritional value that our parents and grandparents.
If this sounds shocking to you, go and Google. There's some very interesting research recently, and not so recent actually, but there seems to be a wave now around this. And just a small spoiler alert, we're going to do a series on nutrient density and the connection to soil health and management. And I'll put a paper in the show notes below of David Montgomery and his wife, Anne, who we'll hopefully have on the show soon as well, that really connected. But there's so much more research connecting what we do to the soil and what happens to our body once we eat what came out of that soil, basically.
Completely. And so I started really studying this, and then working with the head of the nuclear medical clinic here in Munich. He doesn't have a lot of belief in nutrition, but he cannot believe the change I made. And so we've been, you know, working together for years now. And so many people just said, Jacqueline, you've got to put this knowledge and passion into a company now. And I said, okay, but I'm going to find a way that I can really make an impact. Because at this stage in my life, it's not about a paycheck. It's not about building my CV. It's about actually producing a legacy of change.
And what made you change there, or not change, but sort of the logical step seems looking back at targeting that autoimmune disease, or targeting helping others with the same to go through that process, et cetera, et cetera. But you said no, or maybe yes as well, but the company is going to be focusing on baby food or on the first 1,000 days.
Because when you want to tackle a problem, you go to the beginning, and the beginning is the baby. And I didn't know there was a problem in baby food, right? We didn't have a child at this point. I wasn't focused on this industry. I knew the big...
You heard your friends complaining about it, maybe.
Exactly.
But sort of one ear in, one ear out.
People complain about everything. So it wasn't like the trigger wasn't there. And I went and I thought, okay, easiest from the beginning. I went to the shelf of a big retailer here. And I literally had tears in my eyes.
No,
when I
shocking.
Saw what was on the shelf, I could not believe that this was the offering in one of the wealthiest, most educated, resource rich, any positive adjective you can give, countries in the world. And we were giving children 200 jars, 200 pouches, where 85% of the contents were apple, pear, and banana, a pureed fruit. And there is nothing in science that says this is the right way to start children's nutrition.
But it's okay.
And if there is, this doctor should be fired because he has no idea about nutrition.
It's really shocking. Yeah,
it's shocking.
If you have children, I mean, you've looked at this for sure, if you're listening to this. If you don't, just next time you're in a supermarket or in any shop that sells, just look at the ingredients.
Yeah. Your
jaw will be on the floor. I promise you. Okay. So you saw that and we're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I just said, this is it. This is now my life's mission. I'm going to change the trajectory of children's health by changing the children's food industry.
And so why is that, that it's filled with those three ingredients, or mainly apple, honestly, and banana, and
it's economics.
It's the same, what we discussed previously, the let's replace it with something sweet, or let's replace it with the cheapest, in some cases, organic ingredient, but still doesn't mean babies should eat.
Organic
the first
sugar
thing they should
is
eat.
Still sugar.
Yeah, it's not the first thing they should eat, are apple, smashed apples. And so what does the science say there, actually? What are the first things we all, when we get to food, should start nibbling on, or should start tasting?
You know, I'm not a vegetarian, but every child should start on vegetables. There is not a child can definitely have fruit. Okay, don't get me wrong. But if you are going to eat fruit, the fructose in that fruit, if you don't have the fiber from the whole food, it goes completely into the body as glucose. And it's not used as energy. It's stored in the body. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is our brains are formed in this first 1,000 days. 80% of the brain is formed. So just think about how quickly a child, like when you had your little one and our little one, like how quickly they learn to walk and talk and play and replicate everything you do. The learning curves are vertical. And it's the same with food. And the food is even worse because there is a chemical reaction in the body, in the brain, that when you put that pureed fruit in and sweetness, the brain says, oh, wow, yum, I want more of this. I'm going to crave more of it. I'm going to reject the bitter or the sour aspects of food, which you need to develop the taste palate on. I want this fruit or this bland flavoring. And so not only is it not providing the proper nutrition and giving way too much sugar into these tiny bodies, but it is actually training unhealthy eating habits that the child then will develop further and further.
So this sugary trigger that we all notice as we're adults, etc., is formed or already starts when you're super, super small.
Absolutely.
And we need to expose small ones at all the different flavors there are, which many are bitter and many are acidic and many are sour.
Absolutely.
And you're saying this first, I've even read first few months when you start eating also the allergy discussions on nuts,
yes,
etc. Like expose,
expose
to all the different ones. And not go for fruity, sugary, etc. And so that dependency. So what is the alternative there? Like you started a company, like you just blend all the veg. Like how do we make sure we grow children? That sounds really wrong. We grow children into healthy eaters. Like what's that crucial? Is that the full diversity, just like in soil? Is
it
exposure to things? Is it a playing with it as well, in a sense, like it should be not a war, but a pleasure?
No, but you got to be ready for a battle. You know, because I mean, evolution of our brains is that when we taste bitter or sour, we think it's poison, right? That's the evolution of humanity with taste. So you cannot eliminate completely that the baby doesn't understand, oh, bitter or sour, but it can be trained. Like everything we do. And even here in Germany, the Midwife Association even says a new taste, a new food takes 8 to 10 to 12 times to be introduced.
Mm-hmm. So keep going. Don't give up.
Right? It's the same thing. Like if you go outside with a football and your child doesn't, you know, shoot a perfect 50-yard goal when they're two, you don't give up on sports.
You're going to play tennis, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? But it's the same thing. We have so much acceptance and patience in almost every aspect of learning, except when it comes to nutrition. We give up so easy. And one of the main drivers of that is that parents actually have very poor eating habits or lack of knowledge themselves. Ooh,
let's go there. Now, we had to go there, obviously. So what, you have the baby food lines. Now let's first unpack a bit. What is Pumpkin Organics at the moment? And then we're going to talk about the two directions you can take it, obviously, like as the child gets older, but also before, because you say we want to go to the beginning, which is obviously not the moment at 4.5 or 4 months or 5 months, depending where
it's older.
They start eating, like it's earlier as well. So, but let's first say, okay, in a few sentences or a few more, currently we're in the late spring of 2022. What is Pumpkin Organics? How would you describe it if you have to, I wouldn't say pitch it, but if you have to present it, what do you... Because you cannot see it, but behind Jacqueline, there's a lot of food laid out. But obviously, this is an audio podcast, and we don't do video. So it's describe to us what Pumpkin Organics is. Where do you sell? Who can get it? Who can't? Unfortunately.
Absolutely. So Pumpkin Organics, it's a food. It's basically we want to be the leader in sustainable nutrition. We want to teach children with our food, primarily through snacks and through solution-based food offerings for parents, that there is a way to help your children fall in love with vegetables, to reduce their dependency on sugar, to teach them how to make good food choices, and do it with a lot of just incredibly yummy tasting food. So of course, our products are all organic. We are actually the first baby food globally to be certified climate neutral. We are only one of the three companies in Europe that have recyclable pouches. So we really do prioritize the entire aspect of the food. Due to the limitations of the industry or the certification regulation processes and the complexity, there's still a lot we can't do. And so we also offer a lot of recipes and our voice of advice. Like, we're not doctors, we're not nutritionists. We are well-educated, incredibly passionate people that want to help parents teach their children to make healthy, lifelong food decisions.
You're selling in a number of stores, mostly in, let's say, the German speaking region of Europe at the moment. And of course, with plans to go beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah. We're primarily in, like you said, in the German speaking region, in most retailers, in the organic stores as well. We're a quite large online store, which is fantastic because it allows us to directly connect with parents, and we have wonderful discussions with them on the challenges they have. And yeah, no, it's it really feels in the last half a year, more and more people are starting to value nutrition, and we really see a growth of the base and of more and more people willing to try what the child might not instantly like on phase one, which is a fruit pouch, but actually dig into the complexity of building their diet based off of plants led by vegetables.
Now, I suddenly remember when our daughter, which she never had actually normally, like fruit pouches, and she finished one in one shot, because of course it's like instant gratification, and it's like, whoa, this is interesting, this is not what I normally get, and it's very interesting. Anyway, so what you mentioned, you highlighted something very interesting, or you sort of mentioned it. There are a lot of things we cannot do yet, or we cannot do in terms of regulation, and also because it's not that you have your own gigantic factory doing all of this, mm-hmm. which means you have fully control over where ingredients come from, etc. So describe the current situation between brackets and what you would like to do, because I'm imagining you would like to go beyond organic and start sourcing from the places where, because we all know, I mean, organic certification is amazing, but there's a whole world beyond that. And it's a relatively low bar. So what's the current situation, and what would you love to do in the near future?
So the current situation is the demand for baby food is significant, and it's growing, driven by, you know, complexity with just knowledge and what do I feed my child. More women are going back to work earlier, so there's a higher reliance on commercial food, you know, things like that. There's a lot of dynamics in the market that have created a quite large demand on the market. The regulation, the certification hasn't evolved over, you know, too drastically over the years. So the fact that the core recipes that are on the shelves are the same ones that are, you know, from 10, 15 years ago, it might be a new brand, it might be new packaging, but the core concept of the food hasn't evolved is one of my biggest areas that I really want to fight for. And also the core decision makers that are leading the certification, the regulations of the food is the big companies, the big brands, the big agencies. And we need to get some new blood in there. We need to get some new thought. We need to get some people that are actually truly want to drive the industry based on the science, not based on cheap ingredients, accessibility of those ingredients, or what the baby is just saying, oh, I want more sugar. What's going to sell on the shelf? Like you said, your daughter just slurped up a pouch. Like something that's really important with our pouches is they're thick. So when the child actually takes the product into their mouth, they can't swallow it right away. They actually have to maneuver it within the mouth. They have to produce the saliva, which aids in the digestion and also which helps, you know, when it gets into the gut with the bacteria. Also, we started the company with a little spoon attachment to the pouch. So you can engage with the child, you can feed the child right away. So there's a lot of aspects of the industry that I was able to change just by my product offering. But it's been a very, very uphill battle because there was no category for our products at the beginning. And we're only talking 5 years ago. Okay. We're not talking 20 years ago. There was no vegetable category on the shelf. Everybody laughed at us when I told them what I wanted to do. They said, this will never sell. You're competing against mega incumbents, especially in Germany, with the price point so low, what it is on the shelf, I can't even produce for.
Yeah, because it's those cheap ingredients that
completely.
Are. But it is selling. Like parents are buying, coming back, and because they see, imagine they see the results. And so, but you are not able yet to select your farms, for instance, or
no,
to select, like go down all the way down to, okay, I want this tomato row and not that one where they put organic coke on it.
No, because the complexity of how like organic food for babies is still farmed and certified is very, very closed. So there are certain farms, of course, like a certified baby organic broccoli is different than an organic broccoli, different from a broccoli,
oh, wow.
et cetera.
It's like completely a different category, basically, in terms of certification.
Yeah, there are, exactly. Yeah, wow. Because of the contaminant levels in the products and also what is allowed with fertilizers, et cetera, et cetera.
Which is a good thing. But it means it's very difficult to disrupt. It's not that you say, oh, let's use that broccoli. They say, no, it's not from that
completely.
Certified farm and that certified field.
And especially for a company like us that wanted to use a lot of ingredients that were beyond the core five fruits and
nobody was certifying, basically.
Like, it was a nightmare to find, like, certified red beets, for example, or quinoa, things like this, within a acceptable travel distance to our plants.
Of course.
Like, we have nothing coming from far, far away, with the exception of the banana, because they have all baby bananas come from Ecuador in Germany.
Yeah.
We can't grow them here or, you know, in Italy or in Spain.
And so if you would grow, like, what would you need to do? Would you need to be double the size? Like, is it in reach to start controlling more of that process? Do you need to be 10 times as much? Or do you say, okay, that's something that's a distant dream to be in
you
full control?
It needs to be the whole industry. The industry has to come together and say, enough is enough. We're going to grow proper ingredients and we're going to actually regulate the industry that we take away all full fruit pouches. There is no need for them in the market at all. We do not need anything with added sugar or juice or concentrate. There is not a single scientific benefit or health benefit to it. And we just have to actually put proper regulation in for what is acceptable baby food in that first 1,000 days. It should be all the way through, you know, through our lifespan.
Of course, of course. We're going to talk about that. Yeah. But, there's no way, like, this whole discussion now on soil health and the connection to the nutrient density or the quality of the produce. Are you going to introduce or try, or that's impossible to say, okay, we know this farm near Munich that's doing amazing broccoli, for instance, and somehow we're going to try to, as a little wedge, to wedge it into our supply chain?
Yeah, we try, definitely. And we work with our plants as much as we can on it. They
Do they like it? Are they interested in that kind of, or are you just a small and a bit annoying customer sometimes?
So we're definitely probably that small little, you know, annoying child that's always tugging, you know, at your...
But why?
Exactly. But the thing is, the plants and the R&D teams at the plants are amazing. They want to do more work like we do. But the many of the incumbent brands and the other, and the customer base still isn't demanding it. So that's
so you're a few percent of their customers. Yeah, you're sort of the activistic shareholder. But if you, I mean, you're still putting something on the agenda.
Yeah, definitely. And we are making change because, like, it's we are the first people doing a lot of these formulas, and then you start to see them cropping up other places, which is wonderful. So this is like, even though we're one of the smallest brands, probably within the brand, not just the starting brand. We do have a loud voice and we do have a seat at the table at most of our plants, which is really fantastic. We get above our, I would say, share of resources in development and looking at different techniques and working with the farmers, packaging techniques, processing techniques, because we're trying to change the industry and they see that. So in that respect, we are making small inroads. But for mega change to happen in this industry, it has to come from the institutionalized bodies that change the regulation and or basically the bigger brands coming together and say, no, we're done. We're not going to do that anymore because that is against what the science says for first nutrition.
And let's take it to one step. And the demand for cheap food. No, it's like no. You're showing that there is demand for non-cheap food. Of course, there's a discussion or like, okay, if your price point is higher, what about accessibility? How do we tackle that? Or do you see like our stuff is bought by people throughout, let's say, income levels, etc., because people prioritize differently? Like, how do you see that? Are you for the happy few? Yeah. I'm trying to ask, or are you like across the board for people that are targeting better health for their children?
We are not making a higher margin on our product. I do not believe access to health should be driven by your socioeconomic position or your postcode at all. I think this should be actually part of the government's platforms, First Nutrition, that every child gets an equal start, both from an education and a product access point of view. So what we've actually tried to do is, of course, we sell our product at the normal product price, which is about, I'd say, 20% above the market. But that's a big amount in some markets.
Especially if you see it next to each other. Like it's, exactly. It's, that's the problem always with this, really on the shelf. Like,
yeah, it is.
It's just really like framing-wise. You might buy, I don't know, you spend it so much easier on electronics and things like that. But if you're standing in that shelf, you're thinking like, oh, 20%. Or you don't
like
see
20%.
We're
talking €1 items, right?
I know,
and people
I know.
Make choices based on 10, 15 cents. But yet you go and buy the iPhone 12, or I don't know what number we're on, 15, 16 now. Thinking twice.
Yeah.
About it. And so this is what I mean where, you know, if when you asked about what we could change, one of the single biggest things is education. Because if people actually knew really what they were doing to their bodies, I think it would change that, you know, that 15, 20 cents decision. And any person who is going to the market on the weekend or any day, you see the price of an organic broccoli, of an organic sweet potato. We can't do it for the price of an apple. We just can't, right? It's impossible. And so even just the ingredient, you know, amount that we spend, the rest of the production costs are relatively the same. Packaging is the same. We all have the same packaging or relative, you know, it's the ingredients.
So is that what you would change if you had one? I'm bringing the magic wand question in already. Like what would you change overnight if you had that power? Would it be education or like good nutrition, science-based nutrition education for all?
Yeah. I would. It would be it's the root of the absolute need of change in society. People don't inherently wake up one morning and say, oh, I'm going to feed my child bad today. Or it's okay if my child gets a lifestyle disease later on because I didn't treat them well when they were a baby. No parent does that. Everyone wakes up. I want the best for my child. I want to give them the best that I can do, that I know about, that I have access and that I can afford. right? You're not that literal, but that's your mentality as a mom and as a dad or whoever the caregiver is.
And
but it's not what we offer. It's not what society offers. There's so much marketing washing, green washing, health washing on products that if you don't have a medical degree, a chemistry degree, a scientific research background, it's really unfair to put these labels in front of you, to put these products on the shelf when it's 85, 90, 95% of the shelf at trusted retailers by trusted brands. You trust it, right? That's human nature. That's what we have to do. We have no other choice. So if we don't change the way we treat people and by respecting their intelligence and actually educating them fairly, it's extremely difficult to blame them for making decisions that are maybe not 100% optimal for their child's health.
And how do we take it even one step before? Is it first nutrition? But of course, it's not the first nutrition. It's the first nutrition happens in the womb and then happens with breastfeeding or whatever milk you end up using. So I know you're thinking about it. There's nothing on the market yet. What? Because the first 1,000 days, I think, includes the pregnancy.
Yes, it includes
the
belly.
Like in the UN, in the UNICEF definition, that 1,000 days is the first 3 years, including the 9 months, and actually potentially even including the few months before. I'm just going to quote Jeremy Grantham, the founder of GMO, which is badly named, but it's a value investor that wrote a paper. No, it's really he's the G of it. It's not that it's nothing to do with GMOs, but it's. Yeah, that was 50 years ago, I think they mentioned it. But he wrote a paper on chemical toxicity in the baby bust, which I highly recommend. He sent to all his institutional investors. So all of this ended up on the boardrooms, because he's such a respected investor of pension funds, etc. And he was talking about the baby bust and toxicity. And he said, for the immediate present, I do feel a moral imperative to urge anyone pregnant to eat nothing but organic fruit and vegetables, let's say vegetables mostly, for the duration and meant for some, for 6 months prior. For more about this, please see the appendix. I will link it below. Like that period before or the start even, like how would you approach that? Would that be, is that in the future of the company? Is that another company? Is that like, what do you feel about that actually first nutrition even before the whole process
it's
starts?
It's vital. I mean, the success and health of our society starts in the belly. There's no doubt. And when you eat well, you feel well, right? Because there's also so much, not just nutritional science, but mental well-being science in the pregnancy, that if you are happy and smiling, your baby is going to come out happier and more, you know, ready to adjust and learn. And every single thing we do is a domino effect. So first nutrition absolutely starts with the mom. I mean, or whoever, like the pregnant aspect of it and majority. And we have to start educating women when they are in the school system, when they are in just products on the shelf, when we start talking about any aspects of getting pregnant or being pregnant. There is no nutrition knowledge you get from the standard midwife program in Germany, which is amazing. Germany has this system where almost every mom gets a midwife to help them through the process. None of them have nutrition, or very, very few. I shouldn't say none. There's probably some exceptions. There is more instructions on your IKEA bookshelf than you get on nutrition when you're pregnant or when you go to the appointments for your doctor around 6 months, 5-6 months to get a guide on how to feed your child. It's absolutely, everyone is left alone. And when you're left alone and you have no idea what's happening in your body, what's happening in the world around you, you are so anxious. You find bits of knowledge that you grab onto. And this often comes from your parents, right? Your mom or your grandma. And or your friends around you, or completely random influencer strangers that are more worried about their bikini body exactly during the pregnancy. But this is where they get a lot of their nutrition knowledge from. This is so unfair to women. You can't expect women just to wake up one morning and have this nutrition halo above them telling their brain what decisions to make, when we as an entire society do not actually put anything forth to help educate them. So I would love to move our company forward to what we call the belly. It's actually one of the reasons that we are going to start, you know, the larger funding round now, is we feel that we have a very, very big opportunity to help because we truly care. It's not just about finding the, you know, the next big product at the cheapest margin. We truly, really think we can have an impact on women's well-being driven by nutrition during the pregnancy phase. Yeah.
And that seems really like a complete like blue ocean. I mean,
yeah, it is.
There's of course you should take this vitamin and that, but that's pretty much it. There's nothing
that's
on nutrition.
That's all you get.
There's also nothing on nutrition. I've seen some complaints about, oh, there's so little research on like breastfeeding versus not and things like that. And there's one randomized control trial somewhere, I think they did in Belarus. But nobody asked the question, like, what were the women eating? Like, what was feeding?
Because it's not politically sexy.
It's not that the breast milk comes out of thin air. Like, you have to eat something to make, and it's
and you
a
have
very
to eat a lot of nutritious
lot,
food to
of
produce
course,
enough milk.
Like, yeah, that should be the focus there. And then we go one step forward. So, what would that look like if you have any others? Would that be specific like packages for pregnant women or like crucial ones also there? Because are there connections? I would love to know if there's research, like whatever the women were eating during pregnancy, like does that result in less picky eaters later?
Yeah,
or like
yeah.
Is that because also there you're feeding the child, obviously indirectly, but very directly.
So there's definitely in the first 1,000 days research, anecdotal studies from the pregnancy side that, you know, if the mom ate a lot of cucumbers, the child loves cucumbers. If the child ate a lot of, you know, sugar or laden food, the child comes out. But honestly, this is beyond just that connection in the belly, because if the mommy didn't eat that well when the baby was in the belly, they're going to continue those eating patterns after.
Probably.
And
yeah.
When you think of how much knowledge the child absorbs every day, they see that. This is what they're going to be served. So the real, there are not that many hardcore studies that have been, you know, lasted over generations yet or peer reviewed to the nines on this topic, because it is so sensitive in the number of variables when a woman is pregnant, that for the research to truly be verified, I think would be extremely, extremely difficult.
But just to be sure, we know the direction. Let's say it's not, I think there was, David Lezak,
right?
David Lezak and Mandy Ellerton were, we had them on the podcast, on a webinar actually, and they researched this connection between the human health nexus and regenerative agriculture. And they said, yeah, we'll never know all the details. We'll never know all the nuances and all the variables, mm-hmm. but the direction is very, very, very clear. There
Completely.
Is a strong connection
Completely.
Between the two. So we better start acting, because otherwise we're going to wait 20 years for all the peer reviewed papers to come out, and then we're too late. We probably are a bit late already.
Yeah, when you look at the rising obesity rates, the rising rates that children don't actually understand nutrition, we are at a critical turning point but you know, the reality is, like, with regenerative aspects of farming, like, the point is we can make a change, right? Like, this is in our control, and that's the wonderful thing about it. It's not revolutionary. It's just small changes, taking an evolutionary approach to lifestyle changes is going to move the dial. And I think,
yeah, we're not lost. That I think that's
no,
a, we
no,
see, and that's, I think, maybe one of the main rediscoveries, I would say, because obviously for generations and generations in indigenous peoples, we knew this, but the fact that soil can come back relatively quickly, mm-hmm. depending how we treat it, and the mirroring effect of the soil microbiome and our gut microbiome suggests that we can do similar
yeah,
steps
completely.
in a few years or a few months, or we've all heard these miracle stories, but it is at least reversible to a certain extent. Obviously, we're not going to treat everything. Please don't start writing about this, but there's enormous steps to be taken and to be made in relatively, like in geology time, like in nothing, basically in a blimp in history, we can do a lot of things. So
yeah, couldn't agree
what
more.
Would be then, what would you tell smart investors? Let's say we're in a theater full of finance people that are all dressed up. Obviously we're on stage, we're doing this. And then it's the question is, okay, what would we like to give them to them without obviously giving them investment advice, but what would you like to tell them when they walk out of the theater? What should they do the next day or the next morning or even the evening itself, apart from feeding their children if they have them very differently? But like, what should they focus their their work energy on, their mental energy to spend their days on, not just in the weekends when they read the Financial Times how to spend it. Now I want to spend them to spend a week on this as well, their work life. What should they dig deeper into? What should they look for? Where should we guide them?
So this kind of feels like some of my daily discussions at times, because a lot of investors and a lot of capital is being put behind very marketing shiny companies that probably won't actually impact society positively in the next few months, years, or even decade. It's probably a little bit further out to have that exponential or multiplying effect on the health and happiness of society. So that would be the first thing, is truly find companies that the change or the product they're working on has an ability to impact in the short term. Because there's a lot of money that are going behind big ideas. Like, for example, the alternative meat investment, just insane amounts. It's crazy. That's great, but why don't we just teach kids to eat proper plants now? You know, like, why do we need to have all these? Okay, I'm not talking about, like, we need to find alternative proteins through insects and all that. Absolutely, because there's just so many people coming. We have to feed them. We have to make sure they get enough protein and B12 and folic acid, et cetera. But the amount of research that is behind making a hamburger look like it bleeds, or a plant-based hamburger in the way a regular hamburger does.
You could subsidize all children in Germany to eat better for the first
I don't understand that. Why can we not, why can investors not actually see the impact of today, right? That we actually look at societal changes, behavioral changes, things that will impact a huge society en masse. Not that we can just afford, you know, the big celebrity investors to come and back products that may or may not
then you have to be forced, you're forced to really look at the Excel or look at the numbers and calculate what could be done this year, next year, not just because these numbers are always very interesting. After year three or four, they start to, the hockey stick starts to go up, let's say. Yeah. And in many cases, that doesn't happen. But we like to, you know, we like to believe in that dream of disrupting everything in a few years, and forgetting that true disruption takes much longer. Even the disruption stories we tell ourselves are usually 10, 15 years in the making, absolutely, which is still nothing on the large timescale of things.
No, no. But there's a huge amount of investment required behind what I always call non-sexy industries or products that truly impact today's society. And this would be the number, like the big thing I always try to ask of investors, like, don't follow the herd, like be an original thinker, be an original backer, and back things that are truly important to society today, that can make an impact today. And then back the big ideas, but know that that's your longer term bet, and bring some, you know, some of the funding into the nearer term.
It should be a barbell strategy. 85%, as Nassim Taleb says, 85 in boring, non-sexy, but very important things, and 15 for the crazy wild moonshots with Google and things like that.
Could you imagine the impact on our society if we took 25% of our healthcare costs out of the system? If we actually reduced sick days, you know, by 10, 15%, if we increased productivity by 20%, like, these are metrics that we can control. And for that, we don't need to invest, you know, billions and billions into, you know, meatless hamburgers. We need
AI and robotics.
Yeah. Or AI, or I always say, like, autonomous flying helicopters, which are it's super cool stuff. But the impact is needed now, where children and parents are making very, very big decisions.
And so what would you do? What would you do if you were in charge of $1 billion fund?
Oh, gosh.
Let's bring it to Europe. €1 billion fund, what would you focus on? I'm starting to guess 850 million goes to
stuff. You know, really two big things. One is that every single mom start when they become pregnant, all the way to first nutrition, is there's a plan. It's financially covered, or at least subsidized, that every single baby coming into this world and child has a fair start for their brain to be developed, their bodies to be developed, and that they can start in a healthy and happy way and really lead to a contributing members of society. Much like in the Scandinavian countries, when you go home with the baby, you get this little box with a basic thing of diapers and some new clothes, and it's got a bed. So basically their point is that every single child in their first few months has a place to sleep, is going to be fed, have the right, you know, diapers, et cetera. We need to do that. but we need to focus on the pregnant women or the baby in the belly, and then that first nutrition. We have to start the education system, not just teaching people to eat vegetables, but we need to create storytellers, right? Like, society changes by stories, because it's peer to peer. If it's influencer, if it's from a healthcare practitioner, if it's even on this podcast, we're telling stories which people listen to and they attach.
Vegetables,
and they
no
believe.
Fruit. If you remember one thing, vegetables, no fruit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right? And this is the point. Like, I would also really invest in opportunities on how do we educate on nutrition and soil and farming. Where does the carrot come from? You know, kids actually have answered Amazon delivery to some of these questions. Like, this is such a scary part of society. We need to get, and this would be my next investment vertical, education systems into the keto, the daycares, the kindergartens, and the schools. Put a garden in every single kindergarten. Teach the children how to grow the food, how to nurture the vegetables, how to harvest the vegetables, how to cook it together. If a child actually goes through this, it's not just their knowledge on the food that will increase, but food waste will drastically decrease because they see how much hard work they put into creating that carrot.
They will eat it.
Eat it with such great pride, and they'll want to share it. So there's so much that we can do to actually create this grassroots demand for better soil conditions, better aspects to growing, because people, once they become healthier, when you are healthier, you demand healthier aspects of life. And then once you get beyond just how to eat, not just sugar food, but vegetables, you're going to say, how do I make that broccoli healthier? And this is the change, I think, that we can drive by doing basic things in the school system, the keto system. And then when children are older, we should have mandatory cooking classes in the schools. Mandatory agriculture classes in the schools. Because if you took food away, we don't really have a society, right? Like, we're done. And these are the big things I would really invest behind. And my next one would be the farmers. Coming from a farming area, it's not an easy life being a farmer. And often the techniques that are out there in the amazing science, right, from crops, from biodiversity, from crop swapping, different aspects of, like, what is the next level of organic, like you said. This takes investment. This takes funding. And a lot of the farmers are just fighting day by day to get across, you know, and feed their families. So I would really put a proper amount of the investment in to move farmers from conventional agriculture into this, not just organic, but what is the next level? And it's regenerative, which we know now, but then what is the next thing that we can have this holistic approach that we can meet the food demand, but healthier, more valuable food?
And putting your MBA hat on, like, the first few you mentioned on education and making sure that every child, let's say in Germany or in Europe or obviously globally, has access to the right food at the beginning. Is there a way, or maybe there isn't, but is there a way to frame that or somehow figure out a way to attract investment amount for it? Because there's always this, a nonprofit should do this probably in a certain way. But at the same time, the amount of nonprofit money available is
I don't think nothing. It should be done by nonprofits.
It's nothing compared to the investment amount available for crazy moonshot stuff. But like, how could we frame this in a way like, okay, if we run this program, we create enough demand for companies like Pumpkin Organics to grow. Like, how could we connect it to, unfortunately, a financial outcome? How would you do that? How would you,
because you need
structure
to run
it in a way as an investment?
Yeah, you need to run it as if you're trying to build the next $1 billion entity, or if you're running a Mittelstand company or something. You have to run it as a for-profit to build a sustainable business model company. I think one of the reasons a lot of the things I mentioned don't get the funding they need is because they're often managed by nonprofits or by government agencies. And through bureaucracy or lack of speed or agility or inability to attract talent you need to drive a business, it takes 10 years, 15 years, a lot of frustrations, maybe 5x the budget. I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to discredit it. But if you actually started running every single nonprofit topic as a for-profit and built a proper business model behind it with proper checks and balances and investors, you can actually, I think, change the business models behind these. Because there is a business model behind health. We know that, right? Food tech, health tech, all of these are the biggest growing, or some of the biggest growing investment pools in venture. But where the venture dollars are going are behind teams. It's because the idea is only the very small part of where the venture money goes at the beginning. It's behind the team, right? You invest in the founder, you invest in the team. And these teams are often not the people that are running the nonprofit. So I'm not trying to be disparaging. I actually think it's quite positive and quite exciting that if we actually invested behind people that have the passion and purpose for a lot of these traditionally nonprofit topics.
They will figure out a business model.
They will do it. Because we've done it before.
That might be with insurance companies. You need to figure out where the savings are being made or where.
Why are the insurance companies not backing First Nutrition?
Nutrition.
Right? Why? This is mind-boggling. And in Germany, like where we are, this is the land of insurance companies, right? It's mind-boggling how many insurance companies here and the power they hold. But I've never seen not a single one of them have called us. Not a single one have said, hey, how can we get involved to help or do something? And I don't think any other really truly science-backed or health-backed company is getting the calls.
That's really
interesting. It's just easier to pay to put the Band-Aid on or put more beds into the hospital or do X or Y later in life versus actually trying to solve a bigger problem. And it's also not politically sexy because no politician is going to get elected by saying, oh, we're going to give children a fairer start in life.
Right? No, and we're going to prevent the next part of the next effects of the pandemic. We're going to prevent. It's very, but you see societies not changing, but you mentioned like the last 6 months or last year, it's like nutrition and health and food seem to have at least a different spotlight on it now. And there seem to be changes in choices we made. I mean, of course, a lot of local ones exploded during the pandemic because we couldn't get anywhere or we couldn't get access to the supermarket or things were finished. And from the flour boom to where do I get my eggs to where do I get my vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. And some of that stayed, luckily. And I think people got used to different flavors and tastes. And now the question is, okay, how do we sustain that?
How do we scale it?
How do we scale it? And as a final question, I mean, this is a whole different rabbit hole we just touched upon, but I find it fascinating. It would be another interview to unpack, okay, how do we take traditional nonprofit areas and invest in them with the specific focus of turning them into large impact business models? That's a different episode. We'll come back to that at some point. But now, as a last question, there are many like vegetables versus fruit, but when you go to your, I don't know if they're peer conferences, for sure they're conferences of baby food. When you go there, what's the biggest one that you feel, even if you go to the organic, more, say, healthy side of the aisle, where do you think most differently? Is that the vegetable versus fruit? Is it something else? I love to ask this question, what do you believe to be true about Regen Ag, but in this case about baby food, that others don't believe to be true? And this definitely comes from John Kempf as an inspiration.
So I think what I believe to be true that I don't think many of my industry peers is that first food actually matters. That we need to actually care. Like if we truly cared for the child and their upbringing and their ability to lead a healthier and happier life, we would be really vegetables, plant-based, no pureed fruit. No sugar, no additives. I don't think the formula is crazy. I don't think it's complicated. And then the other aspect is healthy people are going to demand healthy food, right? It's once we get people healthy, you don't want to go back to feeling sick. You don't want back to pain in the body. And healthy food comes from healthy soil, healthy land. And I think I really believe that we can, that it's a movement. Regenerative farming. It's not a marketing buzzword. It's a full movement, but a movement needs to come from grassroots. It needs to come from people that are going to truly want to change people's minds and where their hearts, their energy, and where they put their time, and then ultimately their money. I do believe it can change. I do believe it's worth the investment in more recyclable packaging, the add-ons into products that children really learn how to engage with food and live a healthier lifestyle and make good food choices. And I do think we're pretty rare in the industry, not just here in Germany, but kind of anywhere, that we truly think that we can impact children's health holistically and with longer term impacts, starting with baby food.
And this is a good way to end, but I still have one more question I would like to ask. What about biodynamic? We had White Leaf Provisions, which is a US brand that mostly sources, I think, sources all of their ingredients in Europe. And I mean, biodynamic is sort of the a step beyond beyond organic, fully certified, which makes it very interesting from compared to, let's say, the larger regenerative umbrella, where there's a lot of discussion and there should be a lot of discussion. Let's not define it just yet. Are there any ingredients you source like that? Is that cost prohibitive? Yeah. What's the reasoning behind not be fully biodynamic, for instance? That there is a market also for that.
Yeah, there is, definitely. Many of our ingredients are, but unless you have everything on it, you cannot call your product
rightfully biodynamic. So. Otherwise, we get, yeah.
Otherwise, we have more marketing washing and health washing, which we will never do. So there's just not enough yet on it to be, I think, interesting enough where I would look to sacrifice taste development or diversity in ingredients, like the large amount of ingredients that we put in our products, and taste, you know, from sour to bitter, etc. But yes, it is one of the next easy steps to do. It's not cost prohibitive. It's marginally, it's just like organic in the cost structure. It's just there's not everything available yet. And also, we don't have a certification regulation yet board on it. So of course we have DMITA and things like this, but they're also, it's also not black and white. There's products that have that label on them that aren't even fully DMITA. So again, it's confusing to the customer and producer. So clarity, transparency, traceability, as soon as we make all of these things so much more mandatory, I think things like biodiversity will just be one of the net winners. And it's a winner to everybody right now, because it's just the next step.
Perfect. Yeah, we had an interview, depending a bit on the production schedule, it will be out already, and otherwise we'll leak it later, with activist and model Arizona Muse on biodynamic, on the fibers, obviously, because she comes from the fashion industry. She is in the fashion industry, but definitely also on the food aspects, which was absolutely fascinating. If you want to know, learn more, check the links below, or actually not below, check the links in the show notes. And I want to thank you so much for your time. And I know you have a very, very busy schedule. And thank you so much for coming on here. Thank you for the work you do. And thank you for sharing. And I don't think it's the last time we chat about the importance of the first 1,000 and then all the other 1,000 days that follow up.
Yeah, in the next. Thank you so much for having us. It's really, it means a lot that you also let us have another ability to get the message out and really start, you know, fighting for kids' nutrition. So thank you.
Yeah, if you remember one thing, vegetables, not fruit. I just keep repeating it. I'll put it as an undertone in all the future interviews. Don't forget, vegetables, not fruit. Anyway, see you at the next one. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way till the end. For the show notes and links discussed, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/post. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you liked this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.